Alright, hi everybody and welcome to Lecture 52 in this ancient history program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. We're continuing with the most important war in history, the Greco-Persian War. And so today we'll get into this collision between the two cultures and how it happened. We didn't quite get there yesterday because we spent quite a bit of, I think it was time well spent, but a lot of time spent on the theme of the importance of this war. And by the way, relating to that, what do I have for you? On the junior high, that's the elementary. On the junior high class webpage, a couple things to note. First of all, the grading key for the test. So if you're waiting to have your tests graded, there it is. And then also, I have finally put this on the class webpage along with the self-test. I have our anchor fact timeline so far. So this is the completed timeline in the lead up to the Greco-Persian War. So as you can see, Greco-Persian War is not on there just yet. All right, and it will, we'll get it on there. And I'll probably make a few other adjustments. The format of this is something that I keep on tweaking. And so we'll see. Anyway, you can print this off for now, and that will give you a complete representation of all of the anchor facts we've seen so far. So that should be nice for you. So now let's talk about the collision between Greece and Persia. We already understand the significance of it in light of what classical Greece is going to be to the world. So let's talk about how it happened. So it starts with what we already know about Greece. We already know that Greece was a bunch of different city-states. It wasn't, in fact, a united kingdom or single country, really, in the sense that we would recognize one today. It was a bunch of separate city-states, each of them a city acting like a country, in effect. And one of the reasons for that was the mountains, right? The mountains of Greece create a very difficult, basically a very difficult terrain for unification. Because, quite simply, if you're in one city-state and you want to go conquer another one, well, you got to climb over the mountains, and it's not easy to do. Or you could sail around, I suppose, but regardless, it's just not an easy thing to maintain contact between the different communities in a country like this, as opposed to, for instance, Egypt, right, where you just have this conduit, this highway that connects everything. And so this was a more difficult place. And then on the other hand, there's another factor here that we're going to talk about now, which is that terrain, as we also noted before, made it more difficult for the population to grow because you could only support, at a primitive level, terrain like that could only support so much agriculture. So nowadays, if we know how to drill wells, and we know how to irrigate, and we know how to lay pipes, and we know how to desalinate, and oh my gosh, I mean, all of the modern technology, it's unbelievable. You can take a desert and turn it into a paradise. So if you want a great example of that, look at a country like Israel. When the Jews arrived there in the 20th century and returned there to their homeland in the 20th century, and nobody there had done anything with the desert, and all of a sudden the Jews just transformed that place and turned it into an incredible outpost of Western civilization. So in modern times you can do a lot because of technology. But in ancient times, if you're in a place like Greece, there's only so much food you can grow, and therefore you're very limited. But if you're the Greeks, well, when you hit up against that upper bound and you can't grow anymore, but you're ambitious and you would like to do more, well, what do you do? Well, What the Greeks did was they went out into the world. Greece did not offer them enough land, did not offer them enough of a hospitable environment in order to grow their civilization. So what they did was they colonized. So here is a map that's fascinating. It reveals the scope of Greek colonization leading up to the Greco-Persian Wars. This map says 550 BC. All right, somewhere on that order. And what it shows us is that the Greeks had colonized as far away as Spain and France. Had colonized basically the entire Black Sea region. Colonized southern Italy. And had colonized the coast of what we call Asia Minor, geographically speaking. Right? So a lot of times when you are looking at something on a map, you'll notice that there are different names for it. So for instance, looking over here on the left, right, the geographical name for this area is Iberia. But if you looked on a map, what would you find in place of Iberia? Because you wouldn't find it, right? What's over here? Quick pop quiz, geography. Keen.
Spain
and Portugal. Yeah, right. So this is that's Iberia is the geographical region, and the countries are Spain and Portugal. Well, this is Asia Minor geographically. What's it called today? Theo, Rosie?
Turkey.
Turkey. Right, exactly. Okay, so it's a modern country that takes up... So it's kind of a peninsula that juts out from Asia. And I think that's how it gets its name. From a Eurocentric perspective, geographically speaking, if you looked at Asia, it's, of course, this huge continent. But if you're here over here in Asia, then this thing sticks out like it's a peninsula sticking out from Asia. So that's known as Asia Minor. Like the small version of Asia. So that's what it's called geographically. Today it's called Turkey. And you can see that the Greeks had colonized its coast. Hadn't gone inside. Well, the reason for that was there was a kingdom there. And the Greeks and that kingdom had kind of achieved a certain balance of power. Let's go take a look at that balance of power around 550 BC. I apologize for the kind of aged quality of this map. It is not a very easy map to read, I suppose. And you can zoom in on it, though, I assume, if you want to. The thing to pay attention to, of course, is Asia Minor. Here's Greece. Right? It says Sparta right there. It says Athens right there. So here's Greece on the far left of the map. We can see Egypt, of course, with the Nile. Mesopotamia here. And these are the major empires. Well, this one says 600 BC. So around there, all the way through to about 550 BC. Right? This was what the balance of power looked like. Greece was pretty much nothing. We'll talk about that. What really was impressive already by this point was the Persian Empire. As we already know, that one took over everything here. And the other ones that had yet to be conquered were Mesopotamia and Egypt. And, well, here's this other one that we haven't talked about because, well, it has very little. It doesn't have much of a historical footprint. It's just not a very important culture, except in this very brief chapter that we're talking about right now. So it's called Lydia. It's labeled here as Lydian Empire. And so the Greeks had colonies on the coast of Asia Minor, but in the interior, what you had was the kingdom of Lydia. And it was quite famous. The king of Lydia, his name was Croesus, was renowned as the richest man in the world. I don't know how he got that, if there were a lot of mines, silver and gold mines in Asia Minor that you could, that he was able to obtain all of the things that people call wealth. in that sense, right? And as a king and as a powerful person and with all of that precious metals and jewels and so on, Croesus was known as the richest man in the world. So he was famous. And, well, not surprisingly then, the Persians were envious and desirous of conquering Lydia. And this is the beginning of the collision between Greece and Persia. Because the Persian Emperor Cyrus approached the Greek colonies on the coast and invited them to participate in the war against Lydia. He intended to conquer Lydia, and he approached the Greeks and he gave them the classic argument for attacking Lydia, which was what? Persia and Greece should work together. Why? They didn't know each other. They weren't friends or anything. What's the classic argument? Theo, Rosie?
It could benefit both of them.
Well, yeah, but it had to do with Lydia in particular. Right? What was Lydia? Keen?
I think they're looking for the enemy of the enemy of my friend, but is Lydia Greece's enemy?
Well, yeah, there you go. The enemy of my enemy. So, like I said, Lydia and the Greek colonies had this equilibrium there, but they weren't friends. I mean, look at these little enclaves of Greek colonization along the coast. They weren't part of the Lydian Empire, and of course they were neighbors and they weren't friends. I mean, nobody who was a neighbor of anybody else in the archaic world was a friend. The assumption by the Persians was that the Greeks would help if there was a war against Lydia. But interestingly, the Greeks declined. So perhaps your instinct is kind of right, Keen, in the sense that they weren't exactly enemies. So maybe that's why the logic broke down. They weren't friends, but they weren't exactly enemies either. They had found a modus vivendi, which means a way of living, just a way of getting along with each other. And so the Greeks just weren't that interested or motivated to attack Lydia. They had a decent relationship, so why, as the saying goes, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, right? So this rationale of a common enemy was not particularly motivating to them, and so they refused to participate. But, you know, not a good idea when the Persian emperor comes calling with a proposal to turn him down, because he's the kind of guy that's used to getting his way. So when the Persians did conquer Lydia, they certainly did, the Persian emperor also conquered the Greek colonies in Asia Minor. So I'll throw that in for the bargain, because, you know, you're not allowed to defy the Persian emperor. So the lesson was simple. So he conquered the Greek colonies along with Lydia. Now, this does not result in the Greco... This is not the Greco-Persian War, and this does not result in the Greco-Persian War. This is an earlier episode in which these colonies exclusively, these Greek colonies over here, and now I'm going to highlight them on the map of Greece, were conquered by the Persians. Kind of separate prelude to the Greco-Persian War. So we have this region right here in particular. And if you look closely at it, you'll see these colonies. Ephesus, Mycale, and Miletus are their names. No big deal. You really don't need to remember any of them in particular. But the regional name is kind of the one that's famous. And it's right there in the corner of that rectangle there, Ionia. So you might remember that the Spartans were Dorians and the Athenians were Ionians. So that this region is named Ionia gives you some inkling of its origins, right? What kind of Greeks were they? They were colonies. And, well, I mean, that's something important to emphasize, right? What is a colony? It's not an independent country. What is a colony? I mean, the United States, before it became the United States, right? The 13 colonies were a part of what, Abby?
Well, the 13 colonies, they were part of Britain, and so a colony is basically a city formed by a group of people who have traveled from their homeland to settle in a different place, and it's usually doing a favor in some way to the king or ruler of their homeland.
All right, that's not bad. You're on the right track there. If we could render that a little bit more strict or rigorous, what I would say is a colony is a settlement established by the people, a distant settlement established by the people of a country, which is brought under the control of that home country, right? As you're saying, you said favors. It's much more than favors, right? Because if we think about the 13 colonies, for instance, of the United States, before the American Revolution, what citizenship did those people have, right? Who were they? They were Brits. They were British, right? So they were a part of the British Empire. And that's the way that colonies work. So they're not independent. They are tied to their home countries. In this case, these colonies would have had a very close relationship to the cities back in Greece that were their home city-states, right? The ones that had sent out the colonies and traded with them. And they would have had a very special relationship with the Greek homeland. And so when they were conquered by Persia, that certainly was not a favorable outcome. But the Greeks did not immediately respond with conquering them. And this is really a fascinating thing. Because, now this takes us to the question, how did this Persian Empire work? Let us remind ourselves. What was its formula for success, which accounts for its remarkable growth and sustenance? Nemo?
Letting the people that conquered keep their religion.
Mm-hmm. That is probably the most famous attribute because it's viewed from a modern perspective as being a positive trait, an admirable trait, that there was religious toleration within the empire. And famously, the Jews, who had been in captivity in Babylon, were liberated by Cyrus and allowed to go back to Israel. And so that was one of the more famous episodes in ancient history considered to be a very positive thing. That was part of it. But there was one other one. And more relevant here, right? Because the Greek religion, which was polytheistic and involved a lot of different cults, really was not something that the Greeks necessarily would rebel for. They were not particularly religious in that regard. It was an attribute of their culture, but they weren't going to live and die for that. The Greeks, however, were much more interested in something else. Theo, Rosie.
Weren't they allowed to keep their local government?
Aha, very nice. So in the Persian Empire, it was divided up into local regions. Remember in Egypt, you've got the nomarchs, you have the local rulers. Well, in the Persian Empire, you had the satraps. They're the local rulers. And there was a satrap in Sardis. There was a satrap for every region. But on a local level, as Theo is remembering, you were allowed to keep your local government. So as far as being in the Persian Empire is concerned, it wasn't particularly painful, right? Compared to other empires, and that was part of its design, to make it more acceptable to the subject peoples, right? So it wasn't particularly painful. It wasn't this horrible tyranny. It wasn't this terrifying injustice that might have spurred the Greeks back home to go and get in their ships and cross over there and fight, right? It is just something that they had to accept because they didn't think that it was so egregious, so awful. So the initial conquest of Ionia was not much of a crucial event in Greek history, really. And it wasn't that important to the Greeks. It wasn't that important to the Persians. It was really an afterthought when it came to the conquest of Lydia. And as far as the Persians were concerned, remember, there were bigger, I'm using silly modern expressions, bigger fish to fry, right? There were more important things to do in the rest of the world. Because you got Lydia, okay, there was some renowned wealth there. But that actually pales by comparison to the collective importance of Mesopotamia and a spectacular city like Babylon. So that was the next thing the Persians did. So Cyrus went from Lydia to Persia. He didn't keep going to Greece. That didn't matter to him. He came back and conquered Mesopotamia after Lydia. And then after his death, Cambyses became the pharaoh, conquered Egypt and became the pharaoh of Egypt. That was the priority for Persia, to conquer these renowned civilizations, to rule over these great historical empires, centuries old, right? And that had a lot of collective wealth. Greece, on the other hand, was not particularly impressive, right? To have historical empathy here, one thing that we have to do is set aside our modern day admiration for Greece and our association with Greece, association of Greece to these important themes that are so present centric. And we have to realize, well, back then, it wasn't much. If you really had looked at Greece compared to surrounding civilizations, there's not much to look at. It wasn't terribly impressive. So the Persians weren't really terribly interested in that. When we arrive at the Greco-Persian Wars, about 500 BC, this is their empire. This is what they care about. They had expanded it all the way to the Indus, which is basically entering into India at that point. And there's Egypt and there's Mesopotamia, and it's just, wow, they had so much to do and so much value here to be plundered from all these other civilizations. Greece just wasn't very interesting to them. Until we get to a disruption in the colonies, and it's called the Ionian Revolt. Starts in about 500 BC. So we already know the region, and that's why I introduced you to the region, because these are the colonies, they're linked to Greece, and they are conquered by Persia, but for quite a while, it doesn't seem to matter to anybody. But in 500, they're going to revolt, or the so-called Ionian Revolt is going to begin. And it has to do with, well, the mechanics of participating in the Persian Empire. So here's a question to get started on this particular theme here. Theo, Rosie, go ahead.
Well, I have a question.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you were saying how they were linked together. I didn't know if, like what the lines in the map mean. Like, there's a bunch of lines. I was wondering if that meant the streams or the rivers.
Oh, yeah. These curvy lines here are streams and rivers. Yeah, they're rivers.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's fine. So there aren't any political borders on here. It's all physical geography. Yeah, good question. Okay, so you can see Sparta is on a river, right? And so, all right. So now I want to go back to the issue of the, like I said, the mechanics of the Persian Empire. And I want to enter into this question or into this theme with a question for you guys, a little bit of a challenge question. The colonies in Ionia were related, were Ionian Greeks, right? And had a relationship with the Greek homeland and were influenced by Athens, which had become a democracy. So here's a question for you. The Persian Empire, one of its success factors was letting people have their local governments. Well, what about democracy? Do you think that that would have been an option? Do you think that democracy would have been one of those things that the Persians would allow? Why or why not? Keen, what's your prediction?
All right, so I don't have a very logical progression of thoughts that supports what I'm about to say, but it's my feeling, and that is that archaism and, you know, a culture that is still archaic and a culture that has moved beyond archaism, they can't coexist. I just don't think it's possible. They're too different.
Okay. Well, that is a good, very broad attempt to find an answer, right? And you're on the right track, but you've got to think about the context a little bit more closely rather than, it's always good to look at the big picture, then you also got to look at the details and think a little bit more contextual manner. Because when you say something really big like archaism, well, and then you say something really big like a classical culture, it makes it seem as though there's some gigantic divide between those two things and thousands of years between them, right? But actually they're living side by side. And how different are they really? Because are we talking about, you know, the Persian Empire on one side of this, the Aegean Sea, and, you know, Philadelphia 1776 on the other side? What we're talking about is two cultures that are actually at the same level of development, but on the one hand, there's this idea of democracy. So that's what I'm asking here is, thinking of it in context, any other thoughts? Is this going to be an acceptable form of local government in the Persian Empire? Theo, Rosie?
So I'm thinking maybe it would be hard for the Persian government to rule over these two city-states because of the democracy, which would make it really hard.
Well, keep in mind that when we're talking about local government, it's just local affairs. And when you're in the Persian Empire, what is the top issue? What is religious toleration for? What is local government for? Why are these things allowed? Because there's an overarching framework. What's that, Theo?
Well, it's to control the
okay.
To control the empire.
All right. So then the question is, could you control a city-state that has a local democracy? Or does that necessarily make it harder to control? because the people are voting on local issues? What do you think?
Well, I think it could, because especially in other affairs, since there's not really a mechanism in democracy for an overarching government to a certain degree, especially in the Athenian type.
Wait a minute. That's a very strange statement, so I'm just going to just stop for a sec. So, if you're dying, I mean, there is, in modern democratic governments, we have what's called representational democracy, right? A representational government. So we vote for the representatives. But that's not really relevant here because that hasn't been invented yet. So we just have people being chosen from the deems to go and vote. And everybody has a chance to do it. And it's called a direct democracy. That's not really relevant here. All right, so I haven't managed to get you guys onto the track here kind of the Persian context. And it's interesting because, yes, we would think just on the basis of the differences between democracy and, let's say, archaic monarchy, conceptually, we would expect them to be incompatible. But, like I said, here's how the Persians would have looked at something like that. They would say, go ahead and do whatever you want locally. We don't care. That's the whole point of the Persian system. Go ahead, do whatever you want locally. Go ahead and vote on whatever your local laws are going to be. That's just fine. And go ahead and have your religious cults and rites and rituals and whatever. Again, we don't care. But here's the key. When the Persian Empire comes calling, that's where it matters. When we expect you to demonstrate your loyalty, that's what matters. And so the Persian Empire was very capable of absorbing something like localized democracy without a hitch, because it didn't matter. Now you might wonder, well, maybe that could be like a precedent and other people in parts of the empire might learn over time and so on. And yeah, okay, fine. In the abstract, again, you could imagine that over time occurring. But what happens in the Persian Empire? The satrap is always watching. And so is the king's ear and so is the king's eye. And things like that are not going to have a chance to grow. Right? They're going to get stomped on. If you're creating problems, if you rebel, the Persians had no qualms whatsoever about smashing somebody that was trouble. So localized democracy, big deal. They didn't care. And so let's look at the example of that. Now, we expect that they would, and the colonies in Ionia, under the influence of Athens, did want to have democracies and did think that they needed to rebel to get them. And so they asked Athens for help in order to assert their independence from Persia. Whether or not, you know, they were right or whether they needed that help, it's pretty murky to figure all that stuff out, right? But they asked for Athens' help in order to establish democracies and to rebel against Persia. So that looks like, oh, well, there's democracy versus the Persian Empire and it doesn't work, right? But that didn't actually cause the Greco-Persian War. What caused the Greco-Persian War was what Athens did in this situation. Athens had a priority beyond democracy as a kind of abstraction. There was a Tyrannos that had been expelled from Athens and was living in the Persian Empire. And the Athenians wanted this guy. Now, this is one of those strange details that results in so much more than you would expect. But Athens had this Tyrannos that they had ejected and they wanted to get a hold of him. Well, now, who could that be? I mean, we've done the story of Athens, and we had Cylon, who never made it, and we had Pisistratus, who did become the Tyrannos. What happened to Pisistratus, by the way? Right? The version of the story that you know so far is that Pisistratus was in charge, and the aristocrats left, or some of them were exiled, and then they were eventually able to recruit the Spartans to help them, right? And retake Athens. Well, that's all true. Okay, but skipping over some of the details there. What had happened was Pisistratus died, and he was replaced temporarily, very briefly, by his two sons, who became joint Tyrannoi of Athens. And these two were not loved by the people. One of them was murdered, and the other went into exile. And his name was Hippias. So, here he is. I mean, we don't have an image of him. But he was, as this website says, or this Wikipedia page says, he was one of the sons of Pisistratus and was a tyrant of Athens briefly. And his story doesn't really matter to the story of Athens. It's not a crucial, one of those crucial causal steps. So I didn't highlight it. But it's there. It's there. And the Athenians wanted this guy. They wanted to punish him. There was a grudge there that they wanted to deal with. And they thought that Hippias was at Sardis. So things kind of combined and blew up in their face here, because these colonies right here wanted their help to establish their new democracies. Meanwhile, the Athenians thought that Hippias was at Sardis, and they went out of their way to attack Sardis and try to get him. They didn't. They didn't succeed. The city of Sardis was sacked, and that turned out to be the reason why the Persians got angry with the Greeks. So all of this is known collectively, what all of this that happened here is known collectively as the Ionian Revolt. It's Ionia is the region. These colonies, not willing to stay under Persian rule, and looking to establish democracy with Athenian help, rebelled, and the Athenians took it a step further and attacked Sardis. And consequently, the Persian king, at this point Dariush, became angry with Athens. Right before, there's nothing doing. There was just no contact between them. But Athens, the Athenians' decision to attack Sardis probably was the thing that tipped the balance. It wasn't some kind of great ideological conflict, right, between democracy and empire or something like that. No, it was just that the Athenians had their own personal priorities and they wanted to get Hippias. And well, that was a terrible miscalculation, because at that point, Dariush, that drew his attention to them, and he decided he wanted to punish Athens. Because as the Persian emperor, you can't tolerate somebody attacking any part of your empire. So at that point, Dariush resolved to punish Athens. He wasn't interested in some kind of great conquest of Greece. Remember that Greece was didn't interest the Persians. They had the center of the earth there. They were the ones that had Babylon and Thebes and their own capital of Susa and Sardis and these places that were much more spectacular than Greece was. So that didn't interest them. Greece was not some kind of great target for conquest. But Dariush wanted revenge on Athens. So he had one of his slaves got a very unenviable job. His job was to annoy the king. I like this story, because try to imagine you're one of the slaves in the household of the king, And your job is to go to the king every time he sits down for a meal and whisper in his ear, "Master, remember the Athenians." Which, as I like to joke, is basically you're going there to bug him. Every time he's sitting down to try to enjoy a meal, your job is to go annoy him. Now, as a slave, that doesn't seem like a very good very good idea, right? Because you're always just one breath away from getting killed anytime, right? I mean, if you drop the dessert plate, you're dead, or anything, right? Any mistake or any problem that you make, your life is forfeit probably. And so now your job is to literally get in the king's face and annoy him, remind him of how upset he is with Athens all the time, and make him more upset because he wanted to stoke that anger and wanted to go punish the Athenians. And so now, of course, getting ready to do that, who is the emperor going to call upon? Who knows Athens? Who is going to help him to defeat that enemy? Theo, Rosie?
Hippias.
Hippias, the tyrant, the former Tyrannos of Athens, for one. Absolutely. And then, here's the other part, which is in a way worse. And here is where the democracy and the empire don't go together, and where really the profound point when it comes to, right? Because before yesterday I said, imagine if the Persian Empire conquered Greece, nothing of the modern world would ever exist because Greece would be aborted, basically, and would never, none of the wonders of the classical Greek world would ever have come into existence. Well, didn't I just contradict myself today? Doesn't it seem like it, right? In the sense that I just said more recently that, well, the Persians wouldn't have minded democracy so much. They wouldn't care. So which is it? Right? Would you have had, could it be that Greek democracy and Greek classical culture still could have arisen in the context of the Persian Empire? Well, here's again part of the detailed answer. When Darius was preparing to attack Athens, he, of course, went to the Ionian colonies and commanded them to provide an army. So when you were, doesn't matter if you were a Greek tyranny, it doesn't matter if you're a Greek aristocracy, a Greek monarchy, whatever your city, state, or colony is, or a democracy. When the Persian emperor comes and expects you to do your duty, he calls upon you to provide your tributary army. And now what does he want you to do? You're Greek. And now what are you going to do? You're going to go and kill Greeks. Right? These are the colonies of the Ionians. And what's their new job? Go conquer the mother country. Go back to Greece and kill the Greeks. Because you're now in the Persian Empire and that's your job. If the Persian emperor decides something, you have to be loyal, right? That's the ultimate measure. So who cares if you have a democracy? What's the value of democracy at that point? Well, you might say, well, wouldn't they vote not to go to war? What's the answer to that? Kane?
Well, maybe they would, but who cares? Persian Emperor doesn't care.
Yeah, exactly. If they vote against the emperor, well, then they're the ones that are going to get conquered. Again. And if you rebel against the Persian emperor too many times, he's just going to come and raise your city to the ground. He doesn't care. So, you know, you don't have any options here. So what are the possibilities for some kind of flourishing free culture that has all these humanist values that's going to produce all these wonders? Is that really going to happen? In the Persian Empire, where Greeks are commanded to murder other Greeks? Of course not. So it's interesting because when the Ionian colonies were conquered by the Persian Empire, they were allowed to keep their democracies. That was not the problem. They were allowed to keep their democracies. After the Ionian revolt was crushed, what kind of government did they get? They got democracy again, because local government doesn't matter. As long as it behaves, as long as the satrap has ultimate power. And so when they were conquered, they were allowed to have democracy. But when Darius prepared his invasion of Athens, he demanded that they provide troops. And yes, Hippias was going to help as well. So that's where we turn to on Monday. We turn to the first of these violent episodes of the Greco-Persian War, which is going to be an assault on Athens. We'll see how that goes. And then we'll keep going from there. All right. Of course, tomorrow is History Through Art. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow.